Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 262, my interview with improv performer and teacher, Gael Dornoweed Perry. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Today's episode of Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Get your free audiobook download and your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook and access to hundreds of books and podcasts, all included in the membership. Come on, it's time to get Audible. Yes But Why podcast is also sponsored by PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is all about helping you find the right podcasting path for you. Connect with us now at PodcastCadet.com. Use promo code YBY20 and you'll get 20% off the first service or workshop you buy. This week on Yes But Why, I chat with globally beloved improv teacher Gael Dornoweed Perry. Gael and I talk about how much we love performing on stage. We talk about storytelling, cats, and a theory on communication that really blows my mind. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 262. Gael Dornoweed Perry on experiencing pure freedom performing on stage. Enjoy. I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah. The nature of you as a creative kid? Like, how did it manifest for you with your family?
Ah, wow. How was it? I think I was a pretty boring kid. So I was like, in plenty aspects of my life, I was scared of plenty of things. I needed to understand things before practicing them. So like using a slide was a big step. Like using a swing as a kid, I was like, oh, I need to understand that the physics of that thing before I can swing on a swing. My parents often talk about this time where I already knew how to ride a bike, but my bike became a little too small. I think I was like something like maybe 6 or 7. And they bought me a new bike for Christmas. I received a new bike that was a little taller, and because my bike was becoming really small for my size. And it took me 6 months to use it because I really want to study it to know how it was working before going on there. So that was one side of me. But on the other hand, I loved reading. I learned very, very early to read before school. And I loved stories. Before reading, I loved pretending to read books without pictures, because that was cool to imagine what are the worlds that can be hidden in there. And I started playing music very early on too. My parents put me in a music class, and I really wanted to play the clarinet because Peter and the Wolf, there is one character that is the cat. And the cat is played by the clarinet. And because I love cats, I just wanted to play the clarinet. So I think like as a small child, I was like pretty boring in plenty aspects, but I was also quickly immersed into more creative process. I played the clarinet with an amazing teacher who was coming from, who is still coming from Togo. And he learned jazz, saxophone, and clarinet in Canada, and he was an amazing, completely crazy teacher who was taking children both very seriously. So he made me feel like even at a 7 years old kid playing the clarinet, that was too big for me, that I could actually play something that came from my guts. And he took me very quickly in the orchestra, the jazz orchestra, and gave me parts to improvise and everything with the clarinet. And that was like, I think that was a big part of my childhood, of my development as a future potential artist.
Wow, what a great teacher. He sounds so exciting.
Yeah, he is one of the loveliest person on earth. Edge Lawson, Edjojinam, his full name.
Mm,
yeah, a very, nice. Very lovely sir. And I've studied the clarinet with him for like 10 or 11 years. And that was one of my very influential people in my life.
So like your whole, you know, child life, you worked with him, because you said you started at what, like 6 or 7, and then 10 or 11 yeah. years, that's till 18. Wow. That's yeah. what a journey with this guy.
Yeah, it was, he really became a friend growing up, and the whole project with the jazz, the big band jazz that we're part of. So he was directing that orchestra with in mind the philosophy that anyone could be part of it. And so what he was doing is that he was taking jazz pieces that were known or funky or that he wanted to explore, and he was rewriting parts for everyone depending on their level. So we had that orchestra had like both adults that were doing jazz for like 20 years, and it's still an amateur level, but like people that were doing that for a very long time, and small kids like me that were like 9 years old doing the clarinet for 2 years and able, you know, to do a little bit. But he was writing parts for everyone that would make us feel part of a whole, but also was at our level. And that was very, very nice, because the music school I was studying in was directed by the piano teacher, who was also the director of the like the Philharmonic Orchestra of that small town school. And he had great ambitions for his school, and he also had very strict opinions on what was proper music or not, and jazz was definitely not proper music. So it was. I was just lucky to find a teacher that really felt like it was more important to love music than to do proper music.
Oh yeah, I feel like my entire upbringing was people just letting me know that when a person decides something's not proper, it's probably the best. like they're like, that yeah. guy doesn't like it. Check it out. You're like, what? And you're like, yeah, if there's a group of people that are against something, that thing's probably pretty cool. And you're like, really?
Yeah, that's definitely how it felt.
Yeah. I like how your teacher had this idea of inclusivity so early on. They say that, you know, treating children like they're adults and honoring them for the, you know, human beings that they are and that they can contribute in a creative way is a really important part of development. I wonder how he even like, you know, decided to do this. You know, it's just such a wild situation that he would be like, yeah, my whole place is just going to be littered with thousands of different people at different, you know, educational levels, and it's going to be great.
Yeah, I think he was just a very generous man, like, or he is like, he's just like a very sweet and kind person that want to share his, he loves music so much, and he just want to share that, I guess. And yeah. that's the way he found to share that. And the result is that this like orchestra has never been the best big band jazz in the region, but it was definitely the one where we had fun and where everyone was welcome no matter what. And it felt like home very quickly.
Now that vibe of everybody being welcome definitely smacks of improv and the way that improv communities have a tendency to be like, improv is for everybody, come on in, let's do it. Was that vibe that you were, you know, your creative community growing up was so open? Do you think that's what led you towards improv communities, or is that like a secret we only find out after we get into it? Because it's probably a good secret.
Yeah, I never saw it like that. I guess there is a little bit of both, probably. So I was always attracted by associative structures and communities and stuff like that. I've done a lot of associative work as a kid, as a teenager, and then as an adult. I found myself invested pretty deeply in every project that I had. I was a scout during my whole childhood, and I invested a lot of energy in that. I started juggling when I was a teenager, and we created like a junior association. So it was like an official structure, associative structure, but for people that were not adults yet. And I guess when I started improv, I discovered improv at the age of 18 when I moved city. And at first it was just like, I had a friend who was doing that for 3 months. And it seemed that he had fun, and I started, and that was it. But I started in a company in Strasbourg that is an association that is today 28 years old, which is a pretty old association for improv in France. And who is just a big association. Everything is amateur run on a voluntary base, but it has like 200 members and 50 shows a year. And it's just a very big machine where if you want to invest 50% of your lifetime, you can. And that's, I think, what's hooked me into improv first. It's that community, and not per se the everyone is welcome, but more the there is a family where you can do work and you can make things happen.
Yeah. Man, just thinking about the wrangling of both of those things, like the improv school and all the shows you're talking about them doing, and then thinking about your clarinet teacher and all the wrangling that he did, it's like, oh my God, the organizational skills of all of those people, like, amazing. So great that they accomplished the number of shows and all the people that they're getting together to like make it work. Like, oh man, the labor of love is so wonderful. Yeah. So were you inspired to be a teacher and nurture people the way that your teacher Edge was?
Yeah, I think it inspired me in the sense that it was really fitting with me. I have very little for authority, and that has always been the case. At school, I was a very good student. I was a very good kid at school, but I was also, to me, adults always had to earn my respect. which doesn't always make you appreciated by teachers, and I've always felt like this whole thing of like, because you're older than me, I owe you respect, or because you're more experienced than me, I owe you respect, is nothing if you don't earn it. And someone like Edge definitely from the get-go earns my respect by caring for what he was doing. He never asked me to respect him. And he was just putting the work, and he was just doing things. And very quickly I started, when I was a teenager, I started giving extra lessons to kids that had troubles like in math or in physics or in chemistry and stuff, mostly sciences where I was pretty good. And because I always hated authority, and I always hated like the strictness of school, and there is only one right answer, and you have to learn by heart. Learning by heart was always my nightmare. Not per se because I didn't succeed to do it, but because I didn't see the point of it. I'm much more into trying to understand things than trying to learn them, and so I tried as a teacher to also bring that. I tried to be the best teacher for myself, the best teacher possible that I would have loved to have. And I think that's something that I did when I was 14 and teaching kids of 12 math, but also later when I taught at the university and when I started teaching improv. And in teaching is a very important part of my life and something I really love doing, whatever the field, because I've been disappointed by teachers, and I think we can do better.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And why not try to change the world first within yourself before you expect other people to do it? That's really great. I also really appreciate the idea of expecting adults to earn your respect. And now I have every intention of teaching that to my child. Like, no, just because they're older doesn't mean they're good. No, that is incorrect. I know that we told you to listen to people, but not everybody needs to be listened to. Like, I mean, I'm that way myself, for sure. I mean, like, growing up, but I mean, I guess, I don't know where I think I got it. I don't know. My mom was into politics, and we were always fighting somebody. There was always a picket sign or some person where she was like, no, we're not doing that anymore because so-and-so is terrible. And you're like, oh, okay, sure. But yeah, I think it's really important to live a life that shows to the people around you, to children, to your students, that like you are a respectful human being. Not that you're like, hey, you got to respect me, but rather you show yourself as a strong person who's going to be, you know, have valuable information to bring to them as well. I also think there's something to caring. Like really caring about your students. I mean, I'll admit I've taught a lot of improv students. So like, I don't exactly remember every single person, but in the moments that we are there together in that room or online, they're the only people that exist in the world for me. Yeah. Like I want to be with them. I want them to have the best experience ever, you know, and I will do what I need to do, adjust and set it up in whatever way that like will be best for them. Right. So you mentioned you got into improv at 18. Was that just, you know, kick around classes? Were you in school, or was it like a school improv troupe, or was it like going, so you just moved after high school and then you're like an adult person taking classes because that's what people do?
Not exactly. So I studied geology. I studied earth sciences at the university, and I had one friend who is still a friend, Cedric, who was in class with me. He also studied geology. And he was doing that thing, improv, and I've never heard of it before. Improv is pretty big in France in the amateur level, but it's also, like in most parts of the world, something that is still underknown. So up to that point in my town, there was no improv, and I've never heard of it. And so he's like, yeah, I should come. There is a show. And in France, the format that is played the most is the match, which is a format that comes from Quebec, and that's what is played in like 95% of the shows are the match. For a lot of people, improv is the match. And in Strasbourg, there is one of the historic companies that does match in France, one of the first that started doing match when it arrived in France from Quebec, and that is called La Lolita. And it's a pretty big association, and the way it works is that they have two levels, one championship where they're like five teams, and there is a season where they do matches and stuff until there is one team that wins that championship. And then there is another part that is a little more open where anyone can subscribe basically, that has in general six or seven different teams, and they do their little championship also between these teams, but on a more, the teams are bigger because you can come and go a little bit as you want. You have no responsibility towards the association. The shows that you're playing are not, people are not paying. It's still like shows where, I don't know, you will easily have between 50 and 100 people in the audience, but they're just not paying. And so
still I butts and seats. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Strasbourg has a pretty big scene. So like the championship would have 200 people sold out every time, every show.
Whoa, wow.
Yeah. Now that's a really cool, scene to be, but I started and I was like, I went to that show and I was like, oh, wow, that's a fun feeling. And people seem to be nice and stuff. And so I asked Cedric, I was like, oh, how did you discover that? Can I join to do a tryout? And I can't really replace how I did that because it doesn't sound like me to ask, or at least like me at the age 18 to ask, can I join that theater thing? But I was doing less and less juggling and I was stopping to do shows with my juggling team and stuff. So maybe I was just looking for something to do in Strasbourg. And I happened, Cedric had a team that was not going well. So a lot of people left and they were too little to stay as a group. And so I joined that team. And what happened is that 2 weeks later, I was on stage with them because they didn't have enough players.
2 weeks and later, that's so fast.
It was ridiculous. And so what happened is that, like, yeah, 2 weeks later, I was in the first show, and then I took two classes a week instead of one because there was one spot left in that advanced class that I was. And they were like, you want to take that advanced class? I was like, yeah, okay, I'm going to take that advanced class. And I was not really realizing what happened there. But I think in 3 months, I had done like four matches, one long form, and took two classes a week, which was like a super intense beginning. And that was really nice.
Wow. That is so much from nothing to all that is so much. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm like that. Like as a person, I will be like, I don't have anything on my calendar. Let me just pack it with everything every minute. Like, yeah, I mean, that's definitely the way how you
but
do it.
I think I got very lucky to find that because like in France, there is not really improv schools or stuff like that. I mean, more and more now, but it's like companies that that are building a school around the small core of the company, but there is no institutions. And La Lolita is one of these associations that are so big and so experienced in the scene that it is almost an institution. So when I joined that, it was suddenly I was discovering 200 people and I was discovering two shows a week happening, often one free and one in the main venue, and plenty perspectives and people that were running this big machine. There is once every 4 weeks, once every 4 years, there is the international French-speaking Mondial. So it's like an international competition that is organized in Swiss, in Belgium, in Quebec, and in France, and it rotates. And for France, it's that association that runs it, which means that very quickly, I was part of the artistic committee of that thing. And it's like the first edition I organized in Strasbourg, or I co-organized in Strasbourg, we had super big shows, and the final show was like 1,000 seats in the audience, and it's just like a very, very big machine. And that was falling into that big community made me dive hard into improv, and diving hard is the best way to hook me somewhere.
Yeah,
in whatever.
Well, I mean, the fact that it happened to you at 18, I think is a good spot because as my audience will know, strap in guys, I'm going to say it. I have a theory of life that every 18 years, you're a new person, right? So you were just at the beginning of adult you. And so that new chance, that new possibility, you were like ripe for it. I mean, it was absolutely the right moment. If like 2 years later, you had been doing anything else and somebody asked you, it's entirely possible you'd have been like, yeah, it's fine. No, thanks. I'm good. I'm working at the geology store, you know, like you do. Like we make jokes with my friends who are philosophy majors that they work at the philosophy factory. So now I imagine, you know, the geology store. It's fine. I got it, guys. I'm done. I don't need any other activities. But yeah, I mean, because we all get to weird places in our own development where we think we like understand, oh, I'm not like that. And it's like, hey, man, you can be anything. You just be, if that's something you might be, try it out. Why not? Who knows?
Yeah.
I love it, though, that it was like for you, like you still telling the story. I appreciate that you still don't even like grasp how you changed from methodical child to like wild freewheeling improvising adult. Like you're like,
I'm still pretty methodistic for an improviser. I'm still a pretty organized person for an average improviser. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I hear you. I mean, me too. When I started, I have a theater degree, you know, a very helpful one. And, but mostly for years I did stage management because that was what felt like it made the most sense. And I had the most control and, you know, I am a control freak. You know, improv has enough structure to hang your hat on. And that's the other thing. So I'd be interested to know a bit more about the style of improv that you are used to back from the Strasbourg days. And then now, because I'm sure it's like evolved because you've been in lots of places and had lots of different influences and whatnot. But for me, like many people from the States, we're doing comedy-based improv and game, right? But that, oh boy, is the structure that I love and need, right? So whenever people talk about the other forms, I'm always like, oh God, this seems so scary. Because for me, I understand comedy in a cerebral way, and I can be in a scene and like being a character, but also I know we've done this two times and we need to do this a third time. I'm going to make sure that we do that. You know what I mean? And like, and that's how I teach too. Like when I teach my level ones, cause I love teaching new improvisers. If you've never heard of improv, talk to me. Because I try to set it up for them in a way that's like, see this box? It's fine. It's just a box. Look at it. Like, it's fine. And kind of explain to them structures so that they can then sink themselves into it. And then I can be like, oh, it's not a box anymore. It's just you. Like, you understand it, but you don't need these rules, you know? Yeah, we gave you a bunch of rules. Can't do this, can't do this, can't do that. You can do those things if you feel like it now. It's fine. That was just to train your brain in certain ways, you know. And for me, being able to teach that way and think that way, it's the structure that I need. It's the control that I'm looking for. So I guess there's two questions there. One is like, how do you balance your methodical organizational brain in the theater world? And then also like, what's the style of improv that you're doing in France and now in Amsterdam? Like what's the style?
Yeah. So for the methodist part of it, like for the organized part of it, I think I have tried to, how to say that? No. After my second year of improv, my teacher, that was my teacher for a whole year and, who became my friend later and my co-player, He was teaching the same group for the whole year, and we were like 15. And to the 15 of us, he gave a brand and the slogan of that brand to describe who we were as a player. And my brand was Bosch, the brand that does like, I don't know, drills and chainsaws and stuff like that.
Right.
And he was like, you're like Bosch. The German brand is very reliable, but kind of boring. And that was my description of the end of the year. I was like, oh, great. I feel awesome. but I think somehow he was right, in the sense that I was I'm pretty good at observing. I'm pretty good at listening, what is happening, at linking the different dots. My brain works really well on going back and forth between what we're doing now and what is the bigger picture. And that's true for everything in life. I tend to not forget a lot of things, or at least to remember to check, ooh, what are still the things we need to do? Wait, what time is it? On that project that is like a 6 month long project, where are we at, et cetera, et cetera. And I was doing a little bit of that in improv, which made me feel very responsible for what was happening. And the effect it had was that I was not allowing myself to have a lot of fun because I felt, ooh, I'm good at this thing. It's my duty to do it, because when the few times I would not do it, no one would do it, and it would go to crap. That's the feeling I had, at least. And the year after, I started to go into a team where, which was the beginning of the big chunk of my improv career, and the people that were around me were all more experienced and all kind of crazy. And that was just very good for me, because suddenly I was surrounded by people that were, in any way, I could feel like they were more responsible than me because they were more experienced. And I learned a lot on the way to just go with the flow and relax, etc. So today, and that's valid for the last, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years, I'm doing much more free work. I'm less and less at ease with a structure when I'm performing improv. So I do a lot of freeform. I do a lot of shows where we have really nothing, or just we have like a setup to start and then we're free for like an hour. The show we have with Laura is like a romantic comedy, and we have no structure in it. We just know how it starts and that's it. And it's like a 50 minutes, 1 hour narrative long form. And that's what really drives me. That's what I really love. And that's also what I teach. Because as much as I'm someone that is very organized, I am also someone that don't like authority, which means that as soon as there is a structure, I just want to kick at it. So yeah, I think like I projected my need for control, and I am also definitely a control freak in some aspects. My need for control in whatever was around the scene, the stage, sorry. But as soon as I'm on the stage, I'm much more free. Now in the history of it, I started doing improv in that association called La Lolita, and it's improv match. So it is short form. It is a format that is pretty well timed. It's very well organized. One of the big difference between the match and theater sports, for instance, for those who have never seen match, is that the length, the duration of the scene is announced beforehand. That's one of the extra rules that are there. So for instance, before even starting the scene, you know that it will last for 4 minutes and 35 seconds. And then you play in that box. So I went from that, but the problem of the match is that because it is short form, and because people vote at the end of every scene for one team or the other, and all that, it creates something that is competitive and that is efficient and that relies on being funny most of the time, or at least finding variation in that comedy. And I'm not great at that. I'm not very funny. I love taking my time and exploring stories and characters and relationships and emotions in plenty different ways, but I'm not like quick and snappy. But luckily in the same time I started the match, I was recruited by another company in Strasbourg as a very beginner, like after 1 year of improv, because they were creating a new show to play improv in the street that was called The Bench, Public Bench. And they were looking for someone that was an improviser, a musician, and a juggler. And that's where I was like,
it is me.
It is me. And that company was doing much more long form, much more narrative, long form, unstructured things. And that really taught me, ooh, wait a minute. Maybe I'm not amazing at match, but it doesn't mean that I'm not amazing at improv. It just means that that format doesn't suit me as well. Yeah, I think that's a little bit. And today I love unstructured things. I love strong starting points and then the freedom to explore whatever is happening. And I think the show I'm playing with Dan and Cedric, so I'm touring a lot with two of my friends from Strasbourg. And we have a show called Just Play that is a freeform show. And the joy we find in there is basically that really anything can happen. And we have no clue and we have no tropes or no beats we come back to. It's just 50 minutes of whatever is happening then. Something that comes back often is that we are pretty physical compared to a lot of the improv that is out there. We tend to be more silent and more physical and doing a lot of space object and stuff like that. But beside that, it's, yeah, I think it's very free and very freeing. I like that.
Mm. I like something you mentioned earlier, the idea that when you're off the stage, you're still organized, you're making sure everything's going well, you're keeping everything in check, you understand what's going on, the time, whatnot. But then when you get on stage, it's like, I'm able to just be free in this moment. And I've never heard it communicated that way. And I totally identify with that for sure. This idea of, you know, once I get up on stage with an audience, like it's exactly the right thing.
But definitely the people I play with have a big influence on that. So like I can be that free with Dan and Cedric because we've been playing together for almost 12 years and we know each other really well. And if anything, I know that nothing will be ignored. Whatever is happening, they will pick every single thing I'm saying or doing. And that trust make me relax and make me get out of my control freak brain, because suddenly I'm like, okay, cool, we're here. And I have the same type of relationship on stage with Laura. We were in a duo before even being together. And that is a little bit the same. It's like when I'm on stage, especially now with Object of Affection, our main format, it's so relaxing. I can do whatever I want and she will play with that and she will have fun with that without judgment. But I also today have shows where I almost don't play because the people I'm on stage with do not make me feel seen or trusted or valued or I feel judgment. I think I'm a player that needs to feel trusted to be good. And when that's the case, I'm very good. I have that in relationships also. I need to feel good with the person I'm actually with to feel good about myself. And some other people, they need to first feel good about themselves to be able to connect with the other person. And that's an interesting balance that I can see in improv too. I know people, I have friends who, if they're not feeling good about themselves, it will be difficult to connect with them on stage. And for me, I can feel terrible about myself. If I feel good with the person, the impact it will have is to feel good about myself when I'm on stage, at least.
I think that's an interesting detail, the idea of trust in that way. And the idea that I've always thought there's two improv camps. There's the improv camp of people who are trying to use it to be funny, or like, or like compete with it? Because also it's like in Austin, for instance, there's the improv community and then there's the stand-up community, stand-up comedy. And stand-up, now, don't get me wrong, as I've said always and will maintain, Austin is a magical wonderland of kindness all the time. So even though these two camps are dissimilar, everyone's still very nice to each other. But stand-ups tend to be a bit more focused on themselves. They're doing their own performance by themselves. They have a career trajectory, a lot of them, where they're trying to get to the next level of the business, right? Whereas improvisers, and again, there's a few people in improv that are also trying to do that same thing. They're trying to move up the business. They're like trying to get on SNL or like make money or like be an actor in movies. Like, and so the business aspect weighs on them in such a way that, like you said, they're more focused on how they're doing than how the group's doing. And I totally am on board with you when I think that improv as an art, as a craft, as a philosophy, as a religion, is about trusting the other people. It's about creating an atmosphere in which everyone trusts you and you trust them. And the other thing that I like to think of whenever I'm teaching is I'm like, this is about building a team. And the best way for you to build a team is to learn all of the other members. So when I'm teaching level one, I tell them you need to start paying attention to the other people. It's not just about how you are playing, it's how they're playing and then how you react to how they're playing. So if Tom loves making himself an animal in every scene, well, then you just open up top of the scene and you're like, listen, dog, get over here. And he's going to be like, yeah. And that helps people connect better. If you feel seen, if someone like shows you that you've been seen, that helps build the trust, that helps connect people. And little side tip, glad it's later in the episode because the noobs won't listen this far in. Actually, they probably will. But the idea is that it takes the weight off their shoulders. If you're less worried, I truly believe you can be a better improviser when you're less worried about how you are doing. If I'm more worried about taking care of you, then I'm fine. I got it. I'm autopilot everything and it's all good. But if I'm worried about how I'm doing, then there's pitfalls and, oh, maybe I'm doing this and what's happening? And then my brain's thinking, oh, you're not good. While also like, what's happening in this scene? And like, is he holding like a teapot or is that a baby? Like, you know, there's so many things that can go wrong if you're focused on yourself, I think. Whereas if you're like, how can I make sure that like Tom and Janice are having the best time of their lives. Well, Janice wants to have a party in every scene. So we're having a party, like doing stuff for them so that they,
yeah,
you know.
I think it's also an interesting, like there are two things that in what you said where I find very interesting because you're based in the US and I think North America in general has improv associated to comedy.
Yeah.
By default and to stand up, and these two scenes are overlap a lot. There are a lot of people that do both. And yeah. In Europe, we tend, except for the communities that have been built by North American expats, but we tend to be more connected to theater and to have much more overlap with people that do scripted theater than people that do stand-up. I know very little European improvisers that also do stand-up, but I know a bunch of them that do scripted theater. And because improv in Europe is not really a business that leads you anywhere, because it's not comedy, there is nothing bigger to achieve. It means that very often I've encountered communities in which and people, individuals, for which improv is an end in itself. And you either do that as a side hobby or you do that for itself, but you know that it will not lead you anywhere. While when I visit theaters in North America, for instance, I remember entering a VTSL in Vancouver and seeing their Hall of Fame of people that succeeded. And the definition of success is they finally got out of improv. So to succeed as an improviser means to get out of improv. And on top of that thing, like I realized when you were talking about taking care of each other, I think there is a cultural difference between different countries, regions, communities, and how what is the primary way communication works. And the North American culture is a culture of sending. It's a culture where the most important happening is sending, which means that, and it's interesting that you described it like that. It's like taking care of someone will be to send them something that they expect. It's to send them, hey, you will be a dog. Hey, we're going to do a party. And I recognize that in the Netherlands. The Netherlands is a big culture of sending too. The Dutch people are considered rude in most places because in every matter of communication, the person that sends is always in their good right. And the person that receives has to toughen up if they don't want to be hurt, or they have to interpret the way that was expected. But what is sure is that if someone is hurt in a conversation, the sender is not at fault. And for me, as a French improviser, that also has blood from the south of Europe and family that is partly Spanish, we care much more, too much, if you want my opinion, in France, about the receiver, which means that the sender has to take very good care of any type of message to be well received. And there are conventions, there are things that you say, things you don't say, there are questions you don't ask because the person would have to say no, and that would be the worst thing that you can do for them. And so being raised in that like culture of like receiving, to be at ease with someone and to feel trusted, I don't per se need them to send me more. I just need them to shut up and to listen to me. And when I say listen, is also to listen to my body and to listen to my face, et cetera, et cetera. And that's something that I've noticed, like playing. I have plenty of friends from the Netherlands and from Canada or the US, where it's like, I see how lovely you are, but you're just like burying me under offers and things that you're sending without really listening to what makes me happy right here, right now, or what I need. So it's an interesting, I think it's an interesting thing where like, it's good to be aware that knowing someone doesn't always mean sending them what they're used to. I don't know if it makes sense.
No, it absolutely makes sense. And what a breakdown of communication that you've just given me. Like my mind is blown. I'm trying to like collect all the ideas just to.
I think a good example is like a trio, like trio that knows people that know each other for a long time and that are doing improv and that are in trust with each other. If I take examples from people that I know in North America, for instance, like a duo that I've seen not a long time ago. And I know them individually pretty well, is Joe Bill and Lee White. They play together sometimes as a duo. And the way we can see they know each other really well is that they will send information without even checking if the other received, because they just assume that they know each other well enough and they're in trust with each other well enough to handle that. And the way, for instance, Cedric Dan and me are playing on stage, what shows that we are in trust with each other is that we can stay silent for a very long time. Nothing can happen for a very long time. And that doesn't mean that we don't know what to do. It just means that we trust each other enough to trust the fact that something will happen. And there is no better or worst version of that trust, but when both schools are meeting each other, it can be very difficult because you're like, you keep talking, you don't trust me. And the other will be like, you don't say anything, you probably are afraid.
Yes. Oh my God. You know, one of the best things about being able to talk to creatives across the world is this idea. It is like what you've learned from being in those different communities. Like, I feel like I need to save this conversation and just send it to like world leaders and be like, guys, this is the problem. This is what's happening. Because even in the US, amongst different cultures that exist that are mixed together because it's the US, that like what you're saying is what it is. Like, that's how, why people are fighting. And I'm like, oh my God. Like, it's this communication situation, the sending and the receiving, like completely is the problem. And now like one of my goals as a teacher is going to be to try to teach both ways. Is to be like, okay, so I know that all we've been talking about this past last week was gifts and giving and offering. Mm-hmm, cool. Now we're going to talk about receiving and what happens there. Because, oh my goodness, it's just like, I can't explain to you how much my mind is like reeling with ideas, not only of improv, but also of like interpersonal conflict and also cultural differences. When you meet somebody and you're like, I don't know, we just don't click. And it's like, okay, well, where are they from? And where are you from? Because like within the US, I have that. Like I'm from the Northeast of the US and now I live in the Central South. And so the vibe is different. You know, what I'm putting out there, the way I act is different. And so people are often like, you're not from here, are you? I'm like, no, you know, but it's like, I've acknowledged that and found a way to work around it because sending in the communication is still the same, but man, that is such a amazing and great. I'm so glad that like, you've had the life experience to be in different communities such that you were able to like give me that information right now. Like,
I learned a lot from my marriage too. So,
good. Yeah.
That's part of the, I mean, both Laura and I are very aware of the differences in culture between France and the Netherlands. And I'm definitely not the Frenchest French person, and she's definitely not the Dutchest Dutch person. We're both of us traveling enough and being in the international connection enough to have like leveled some sort of a middle ground. But we still find place moments where we're like, oh, this is this point. This is exactly that moment where you expect me to say it out loud if I'm uncomfortable, and I expect you to read the signs of me being silent as my discomfort, you know, like this, like this moment where both parties do expect the opposite from each other. And I found myself on stage with people that would, because I started a scene silent, would just assume that I didn't know what to do and would like tell me literally in on stage, don't worry, I will take care of driving that scene. And I'm like, I wrote an article on that. I was inspired by the terms in biology, a dominant and recessive. A dominant gene can exist by itself, whatever is happening around, and a recessive gene needs another recessive to happen. So like, the most classical is the color of the eyes, right? Blue eyes is recessive, and brown eyes are is based on a dominant gene. And there is this thing in improv where I discovered that every skills we have, every tool we use is either dominant or recessive. A visual information in improv is recessive. It needs the other player to play along to exist. While speaking is dominant, because when you are not speaking, if I'm speaking, it can still exist. But if you want silence in the scene and I'm speaking, silence cannot exist. And I think that is that, like, the combination between the cultural aspect of communication and what is your skill sets, and I happen to have a skill set that is mostly recessive, it can sometimes feel ooh, wow, we don't really understand each other.
Yeah.
But it's very, and that's why I love traveling, to discover these things and learn from other perspectives.
Wow. Amazing. Man, I could talk to you about this for another couple hours, but let me just get, let me ask you one more question about what you got going on. And then thank you so much for giving me your time today. What is the fun or whatever creative thing that you are working on right now that excites you? Like, what's the thing that you like woke up thinking about, and like, what's the idea? And it doesn't have to be a show that you're doing. It could be like a kernel of an idea, or like a story you're writing, or hey, maybe even music that you're composing. Like, but what's the creative excitement that's in your brain right now?
That's a very interesting question that circles back to me being both a Methodist and a creative. I have one project that is more exciting on the organizational part. I'm working on a project that I didn't make public yet that is called
You don't have to tell me any details, no secrets.
Yeah, I'll tell it because you know, if I start talking about it, it will exist, not only in my head.
Yeah, maybe.
So yeah, it's called the Improv Learning Center, and I want to have a database of courses online that you can take as video courses, so without having to be there at a certain time, like plenty online courses and resources. But for improv, we don't have that a lot. The reason why I want to do that is because the last year has been challenging for most improvisers, because we cannot really do any improv on stage. And I have been very inspired by some of the things that happened online, but I did not wrap my head around the playing scenes online. That's not something that I enjoy per se doing or seeing or teaching. So I've been teaching a lot of improv online, but based on exercises and skills and tools and discussions and stuff that would make us apply them offline. And there is a lot of offer for playing online, and I'm very happy there is, because there are plenty of people that are that it's some sort of a saving life jacket in these times that are super difficult. But I have some sort of like, I have FOMO of all these classes that have amazing blurbs and amazing themes, but that I don't want to take because I know that I will have to play scenes in it, and that's not what I want right now. So basically is to give people like me, because I think there are people like me, the opportunity to take classes without having to interact socially. Basically that's like improv for introverts. But that's more the organization part, and that's a very big project I'm working on right now. Something that I've been working on the more creative part is that on the last 3 years I've worked a lot on improvising in the genre of Miyazaki, the Japanese director of A Neighbor Totoro or Spirited Away and these movies. And that has been very, very inspiring to me. I've learned plenty of things from his movies, from studying his movies and reading plenty of stuff. And I've taught a lot about that. And because we cannot open our school in Amsterdam live until September, we are now teaching mini lessons of like three classes online. And the thing I decided to do is to use that to explore things that are not improv and what can we learn from it to do improv. So I taught a comic books, graphic novel inspired improv class, where we would like nerd about comic books, draw comic books and stuff, and see how we can use that in improv. I'm now currently designing, because I'm going to teach that next week. So next week of the 1st of April, when we record this, a class inspired by writing. So a writing class about dystopia and other fantastic worlds. I'm planning to do a in May a radio, completely radio play, because I read a lot of audiobooks. So basically, my head is now very bubbling creatively with everything that is not improv and that I can drag back into improv. And I think that's my biggest source of inspiration, is everything that is not improv, but that I can use in improv. I love that. It's yeah. super nerdy.
No. I mean, it's super nerdy for theater people, but this is the right crowd. Like, the it's nerdy, but for us.
Yeah. Yeah, it's nerdy, like, in a positive way.
Super cool. Yeah, when I saw your class advertised about writing dystopian worlds, I was like, yeah, okay, yeah, all right, let's do this. Even though, like, every time I watch a television show with a dystopian world, I'm like, yeah, welcome to real life. But I'm like, no, sci-fi and you know, fantastical worlds is like a wonderful way to exercise your brain. I think that's so great. And good on you for, like, finding a way to make it work for yourself. Like, we have to be creative during a time when we maybe can't get out of, you know, what's available, what we need, you know? And so what a great way to have adjusted and figured out how to get your joy, but without anything too crazy.
Yeah. And I'm playing a live show for the first time this weekend.
Oh,
I mean, it will be streamed, but, like, it's there is no crowd in the theater or anything. It's filmed and streamed, but it's still in a real stage with a real partner. I mean, it's with Lauha, so there is no extra risk because we live together anyway. But it's pretty exciting to go back on stage and have a show.
Yeah, that's great. Oh, I wasn't sure. Some places are back in, like Australia is, but Australia really didn't get it. I mean, yeah, they got a little bit, but there was more like a, as opposed to like, oh, whoa.
The Netherlands is a mess.
Yeah. Us too. Well, hey, Gael, thank you so much for being on the show and sharing stories with me. I feel like we talked about some great stuff and I've been inspired all the way through. So I'm really honored to have you on the show. Your name and your reputation precedes you. You know, I've definitely heard of you before I asked you for a long time, actually. I actually waited until we interacted on the food group one time before I asked you, because I was like, you're not just walking in and being like, oh, hey, what's up? Be on my show. Like, so, but thank you for saying yes and doing it and sharing your stories.
Thank you for having me. It was super lovely. I really had fun. And it's like, you succeeded, we talked about it before, but you succeeded to get stories that I've never told in any other interview or podcast. So good job.
Yeah, good, good. That is definitely my goal.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.